Today we're going to be looking at 2 Kings chapter 6, which leads into chapter 7. There's an unfortunate chapter division there, so we're going to just finish the story. Hopefully you didn't stop reading at the end of the chapter. 2 Kings chapter 6. Now the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, "Behold, now the place before you where we are living is too limited for us. Please let us go to the Jordan, and each of us take from there a beam, and let us make a place there for ourselves that we may live." So he said, "Go." Then one said, "Please be willing to go with your servants." And he answered, "I shall go." So he went with them, and when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was felling a beam, the axe head fell into the water, and he cried out and said, "Alas, my master, for it was borrowed." Then the man of God said, "Where did it fall?" And when he showed him the place, he cut off a stick and threw it in there and made the iron float. He said, "Take it up for yourself." So he put out his hand and took it. Now notice the request that this one man made, you know, "Please go with us." It is no wonder that he said that, because Elisha with them could deal with any emergency. Now remember Elisha's request of Elijah. He wanted a double portion of the Spirit. And so, is our walk with God so effective that people just want us to be there, whether we do anything or not? In other words, they didn't say, "Elisha, could you come and do these things? Could you come help us with this thing?" They just wanted him to be there. It reminds me of a man named Praying Hyde. He was so outstanding in prayer that people would want him to come to evangelistic meetings. And usually he would just go somewhere in the building or somewhere, and he would just pray. And they saw his praying as so effective that they wanted him to be at the meetings, because the meetings would be transformed. It wasn't that he was praying publicly in the meeting, but he was there. And so one of the things we can ask ourselves is, how much do we desire the presence of the Lord in daily activity? I think sometimes we just live our lives and, you know, "Lord, please, bless us today." But we aren't thinking about the presence of the Lord. And notice also this individual, he had a great concern about this axe head that fell into the water. I mean, that was a huge loss. And his attitude was not, "Well, this is the Lord's work and God owns everything, and whoever owns that axe head, too bad for them. They should just praise the Lord." You know, he realized that this thing that he was using, and it got lost when he was using it, he was responsible to return it. It also shows us how God has concern about the ordinary events of life. Now, it's very likely that this loss could have been prevented. I mean, the axe head must not have been securely fastened. So you should learn how to fasten your axe head. Thank you. Or maybe he had poor footing as he was doing the chopping, and he slipped and lost his balance. And so, you know, you should learn how to position yourself and take some precautions. You know, there are many things that we do imperfectly. And even if we're trying to be careful, there are some things that we look back and say, "Oh, I should have avoided that problem if I just have been thinking a little more carefully, or if I'd been more alert." But this episode helps us see that God can intervene for us even when we have been imperfect. And so God knows our fallibility and can minister to us anyway. So one of the questions we can ask, are we going to allow these troubles to be opportunities for the Lord to reveal himself? And so maybe at the end you can think of some episodes in your life that you'd like to share where the troubles came and you used them to allow the Lord to reveal himself to you. This brings us to the next paragraph, verse 8. Now the king of Aram was warring against Israel, and he counseled with his servants, saying, "In such and such a place shall be my camp." The man of God sent word to the king of Israel, saying, "Beware that you do not pass this place, for the Arameans are coming down there." The king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God had told him. Thus he warned him, so that he guarded himself there more than once or twice. Now the heart of the king of Aram was enraged over this thing, and he called his servants and said to them, "Will you tell me which of us is for the king of Israel?" One of his servants said, "No, my lord, O king. But Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom." So he said, "Go and see where he is, that I may send and take him." And it was told him, saying, "Behold, he is in Dothan." He sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night and surrounded the city. Now when the attendant of the man of God had risen early and gone out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was circling the city. And his servants said to him, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" So he answered, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see." And the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. When they came down to him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, "Strike this people with blindness, I pray." So he struck them with blindness according to the words of Elisha. Then Elisha said to them, "This is not the way, nor is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek." And he brought them to Samaria. When they had come into Samaria, Elisha said, "O Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see." So the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. Then the king of Israel, when he saw them, said to Elisha, "My father, shall I kill him? Shall I kill them?" He answered, "You shall not kill them. Would you kill those you have taken captive with your sword and with your bow? Set bread and water before them, that they may eat and drink and go to their master." So he prepared a great feast for them, and when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they went to their master. And the marauding bands of the Arameans did not come again into the land of Israel. Now notice that in this account, Elisha continues to provide blessings for a corrupt king of Israel. He is the instrument of bringing blessings, national blessings, to the national operations of a king who is antagonistic to God. If you notice verse 31 and 32 of the chapter, Elisha calls him the son of a murderer. And so the king of Israel benefits from God working to reveal himself, even though the king is totally unworthy. He's saved from these Syrian traps. Elisha is significantly operating to stop these marauding bands that come. Notice that success is no guarantee of right standing with God. So many people think, "Well, I'm succeeding, so that proves I'm in right standing with God." And so here is Elisha. He's delivering a corrupt king from the raids of the Syrians. That's an interesting thing, isn't it? In a sense, the king is Elisha's enemy, in a spiritual sense, in many ways. He's working against God, and yet Elisha is freely giving him things that come as benefits from God. You see, that's an example of loving your enemy. And the Syrian king's response to this is, "What is going on? Who is being treacherous here in my camp? Who is telling the king of Israel where I'm going to come?" And one of his servants says, "Nobody. It's that the prophet Elisha tells the king of Israel what you say in your bedroom." Well, the Assyrian king says, "We're going to fix this." And so he gathers up this huge force to capture Elisha, horses, chariots, big army. And what he doesn't seem to think about is, well, if this man can know what I say in my bedroom, what other powers might he have? And if he knows this because he's in connection with the God of heaven, or the Israelite God, whoever that might be, which I would guess that the Syrian king had heard about that God, well, what else might he do? You know, in many situations, people do not seriously think about the signposts that are sitting in their view saying, taking this course doesn't make sense. because of this and this reason. So he thinks that if he has a big army up there, he can capture Elisha and do as he pleases. Well, the next morning, Elisha's servant goes out, and he discovers this huge army. Apparently, he went out early, and I think it's likely that this young man is a successor to Gehazi, who had been put out of the ministry. And he returns with this alarming news that there's this big army and horses and chariots. This is a big crisis. Now, often spiritual opportunity does come at a crisis. And so there they are, surrounded by this powerful Syrian army. They have the most advanced weapons of the day, the chariot forces. And it's impossible, really, to be safe at Dothan, which is just a small village. It's not a heavily fortified city. But notice, Elisha is not even alarmed. And he does not berate this young man for his weak faith, but instead he comforts him with the truth. He says, "Do not be afraid." Now, sometimes a statement like that by itself is not helpful. Somebody is very fearful about something and you tell them, "Don't be afraid." That doesn't alleviate their fears. But notice, Elisha didn't stop there. He said that those that are with us are more than those that are with them. And then he proceeds to make a request. Notice the content of this prayer. Elisha does not pray that an angelic force would come. They were already there. Elisha knew they were there. Nobody else knew they were there. And Elisha didn't even pray that he himself could see them. It's very possible that Elisha didn't see them either, but he knew they were there. Elisha didn't need to have a visual display of something. So many people want some kind of visual display. You know, it's like the golden calf. Why do they want a golden calf? Well, we don't know whatever happened to Moses. And so make us a God that can lead us out to where we're going. Give us a God that we can see and touch, even if the God is false. So many times people want something that they can see. Well, Elisha, of course, is way beyond this. He knows God's forces are there, and so he doesn't even need a visual demonstration of it. But this one who's younger in the faith and less experienced in spiritual matters needs some encouragement. And so Elisha prays that his servant's eyes could be opened and so that his servant could see the extent of this force around them. And notice, the manifestation of that force was the miracle, not the presence. The presence was already there. And so the result is a picture as God sees it, and that is chariots around Elisha. Notice, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. So one of the things that we need to remember is that in a crisis, God wants us to trust in him. And so one of the things we need to do is to have our eyes open spiritually to see what is actually there. Notice that Elisha did ask for a miracle, but it's very different from the kind of miracle that people often ask for. He did not ask for a miracle of deliverance. He asked for a miracle that would involve the spiritual instruction of his servant. And then, when these men came down to him, verse 18, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, "Strike this people with blindness." He asked God to incapacitate the Syrians. Notice the horses and chariots had nothing to do with it, if you understand what I mean. The horses and chariots of fire the thing he asked for. He didn't say, okay, go ahead and slaughter them, please. No, it was incapacitate them with blindness, because you can see that from the story itself that Elisha is not intending to destroy them. He wants to bless them. So he took them to Samaria, and he asked God then to open their eyes. And when they opened their eyes, they saw they were in Samaria of all places. And so there they were. They hoped to catch a man who was in a helpless situation where no one could help him. Instead, the helpless man, through the power of God, led them to a place where they were in a helpless condition and in a hopeless situation. And then the Israelite king, carnal and wicked as he was, his idea was, here's our chance. Let's kill him. Let's kill him. You know, take advantage of somebody who's trapped in a way that he would not even treat prisoners of war. Now, if he would have killed those people, it would have frustrated the intention of the miracle. Because, you see, God wanted these Syrians to know that they were dealing with the prophet of the true God, against whom no power was effective. And so Elisha says, no, have a special feast. So you see what Elisha did. He asked for a miracle of temporary disaster on the Syrians so that he could bring a greater blessing on them, not to destroy them. Now notice the contrast here. Elisha prayed that God would open the eyes of the servant so that he would have a greater understanding, a greater vision. But he also prayed that he would blind other people so that they would not even be able to see physically, so that ultimately they would be able to come to a spiritual understanding. In other words, God is working in different ways according to where the need is. And so Elisha utilized blindness to bless opposites. That takes spiritual skill. You see, he was teaching the king a lesson on kindness. And he was also producing a situation where raiders would no longer come. If your enemy had a God like this, you would think twice about attacking him, wouldn't you? Now notice what Elisha does. You see, at one point he's praying for his servant that he might see things that nobody else can see, because he's ministering to that person at his point of need. At another point, he's praying for a whole army that they won't be able to see physically, so that they get to a certain place where when their eyes are opened physically, they'll have a greater understanding of what God is really like, and at the same time be dealing with this Israelite king and his folly. And of course, there are Israelites there that are observing this thing that they need to learn something too. That brings us now to verse 24. Now it came about after this that Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, gathered all his army and went up and besieged Samaria. There was a great famine in Samaria, and behold, they besieged it until a donkey's head was sold for 80 shekels of silver and a fourth of a cab of dove's dung for 5 shekels of silver. As the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, a woman cried out to him, saying, help, my lord, O king. He said, if the Lord does not help you, from where shall I help you? From the threshing floor or from the wine press? And the king said to her, what is the matter with you? And she answered, this woman said to me, give your son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow. So we boiled my son and ate him. And I said to her on the next day, give your son that we may eat him. But she has hidden her son. Now, let's just look back at another place. Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 52 to 57. God is talking about what will happen when the Israelites as a nation refuse to follow God. Maybe we'll back up just a little bit and start reading at Deuteronomy 28, verse 49. The Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth, as the eagle swoops down, a nation whose language you shall not understand, a nation of fierce countenance who will have no respect for the old nor show favor to the young. Moreover, it shall eat the offspring of your herd and the produce of your ground until you are destroyed, who also leaves you no grain, new wine or oil, nor the increase of your herd or the young of your flock until they have caused you to perish. It shall besiege you in all your towns until your high and fortified walls in which you trusted come down throughout your land. And it shall besiege you in all your towns throughout your land which the Lord your God has given you. Then you shall eat the offspring of your own body, the flesh of your sons and of your daughters whom the Lord your God has given you during the siege and the distress by which your enemy will oppress you. The man who is refined and very delicate among you shall be hostile toward his brother and toward the wife he cherishes and toward the rest of his children who remain, so that he will not give even one of them any of the flesh of his children which he will eat, since he has nothing else left during the siege and the distress by which your enemy will oppress you in all your towns. The refined and delicate woman among you, who would not venture to set the sole of her foot on the ground for delicateness and refinement, shall be hostile toward the husband she cherishes and toward her son and daughter, and toward her afterbirth which issues from between her legs, and toward her children whom she bears, for she will eat them secretly for lack of anything else during the siege and the distress by which your enemy will oppress you in your towns. Do you see how what happened there in Samaria was a fulfillment of what God had to say back in Deuteronomy? God's word will stand. You see, God's word is going to be fulfilled even though it looks totally impossible. Now, notice how ugly sin is here. This episode with the woman. You know, sin always looks appealing at first. There's that beautiful garment from Babylon. Oh, didn't that be nice? Or that interesting girlfriend whose heart is not totally set on following God. I think she would be very nice. Or that money that can be obtained through misrepresenting just a little bit the thing I'm trying to sell. You know, there are all kinds of temptations where we can say, well, you know, I know God says this, but... Well, notice this woman that's complaining on the wall. It shows her utter callousness in terms of what she had done. Her major concern was not the loss of her son that she and this other woman had eaten. The major concern is that she's not going to get to eat her neighbor's son. Now notice, as we keep reading, when the king heard the words of the woman, this is back in 2 Kings chapter 6, verse 30, when the king heard the words of the woman, he tore his clothes. Now he was passing by on the wall, and the people looked, and behold, he had sackcloth beneath on his body. Then he said, may God do so to me and more also if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on him today. Now Elisha was sitting in his house, and the elders were sitting with him. And the king sent a man from his presence, but before the messenger came to him, he said to the elders, do you see how this son of a murderer has sent to take away my head? Look, when the messenger comes, shut the door and hold the door shut against him. Is not the sound of his master's feet behind him? While he was still talking with them, behold, the messenger came down to him, and he said, behold, this evil is from the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer? Then Elisha said, listen to the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, tomorrow about this time, a measure of fine flour will be sold for a shekel, and two measures of barley for a shekel in the gate of Samaria. The royal officer on whose hand the king was leaning answered the man of God and said, behold, if the Lord should make windows in heaven, could this thing be? Then he said, behold, you will see it with your own eyes, but you will not eat of it. Now there were four leprous men at the entrance of the gate, and they said to one another, why do we sit here until we die? If we say, we will enter the city, then the famine is in the city, and we will die there. And if we sit here, we die also. Now therefore come, and let us go over to the camp of the Arameans. If they spare us, we will live, and if they kill us, we will but die. They arose at twilight to go to the camp of the Arameans. When they came to the outskirts of the camp of the Arameans, behold, there was no one there. For the Lord had caused the army of the Arameans to hear a sound of chariots and a sound of horses, even the sound of a great army, so that they said to one another, "Behold, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians to come upon us." Therefore they arose and fled in the twilight and left their tents and their horses and their donkeys, even the camp just as it was, and fled for their life. When these lepers came to the outskirts of the camp, they entered one tent and ate and drank and carried from there silver and gold and clothes, and went and hid them, and they returned and entered another tent and carried from there also and went and hid them. Then they said to one another, "We are not doing right. This is the day of good news, but we are keeping silent. If we wait until morning light, punishment will overtake us. Now therefore come, let us go tell the king's household." So they came and called to the gatekeepers of the city, and they told them, saying, "We came to the camp of the Arameans, and behold, there was no one there, nor the voice of man, only the horses tied and the donkeys tied in the tents, just as they were." The gatekeepers called and told it within the king's household. Then the king arose in the night and said to his servants, "I will now tell you what the Arameans have done to us. They know that we are hungry. Therefore they have gone from the camp to hide themselves in the field, saying, 'When they come out of the city, we will capture them alive and get into the city.'" One of the servants said, "Please, let some men take 5 of the horses which remain, which are left in the city. Behold, they will be in any case like all the multitude of Israel who are left in it. Behold, they will be in any case like all the multitude of Israel who have already perished. So let us send and see." They took therefore 2 chariots with horses, and the king sent after the army of the Arameans, saying, "Go and see." They went after them to the Jordan, and behold, all the way was full of clothes and equipment which the Arameans had thrown away in their haste. Then the messengers returned and told the king. So the people went out and plundered the camp of the Arameans. Then a measure of fine flour was sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel, according to the word of the Lord. Now the king appointed the royal officer on whose hand he leaned to have charge of the gate. But the people trampled on him at the gate, and he died just as the man of God had said, who spoke when the king came down to him. It happened just as the man of God had spoken to the king, saying, 2 measures of barley for a shekel and a measure of fine flour for a shekel will be sold tomorrow about this time at the gate of Samaria." Then the royal officer answered the man of God and said, "Now behold, if the Lord should make windows in heaven, could such a thing be?" And he said, "Behold, you will see it with your own eyes, but you will not eat of it." So it happened to him, for the people trampled on him at the gate, and he died. Notice that when the king heard what this woman said about eating her son one day and they wanting to eat the neighbor's son the next day, that the king threatens Elisha. Utter foolishness. He was threatening the one who was actually the best defense of the whole kingdom. And it's so typical. Those who despise God will threaten and try to destroy the one who's the messenger of God. Notice how God works through utter hopelessness. These lepers were outcasts. They had no hope in society. They knew that if they went into the city, they would starve to death. They knew they might die at the hands of the Syrians. But they were desperate. It's like, we can't lose anything. If we stay here, we'll die. If we go into the city, we'll die. If we go to the camp of the Syrians, well, they might let us live. So what can we lose? Well, the first thing they did, they satisfied their hunger. And then it's like, well, look at this, look at this, look at this. They gathered it up, hid it, went out, gathered up some more. And then they realized, you know what? We should be sharing this good news. And notice what they understood. They understood that judgment would come if they would fail to share the good news. You know, God has ways of bringing justice in situations. By the way, that has some implications too in relation to evangelism, doesn't it? Do you look for opportunities to share something about Christ, or are you sort of afraid to share something about Christ? And notice, God brings the solution from a totally unexpected source. He caused the people that were surrounding the city to hear an army. They heard an army coming. There was no army coming. They just heard one. God could do that. Now, that's quite a miracle. And they were so frightened by this that they left their horses and fled. Now, it does show you that God can easily change a situation through faulty understanding of the enemy. Remember when there was that battle against Moab, and they got up in the morning, and they looked out, and they saw the sunlight reflecting off of those water-filled trenches, and they said, oh, they've gotten in a fight. They've killed each other. Let's go get the spoil. And, of course, they just ran into an army that was fully prepared for them. It shows us how the gates of hell, the councils of hell, will not prevail against the true followers of Christ. And the king thought, huh, this must be a trick. They left their horses. But the people of the city are also desperate. And so we just as well send five people to check it out, or however many it was. And if they go and are killed, they'll be like those who have already died. If those five stay, they will be like those who are perishing in the city. And what they went out and found was equipment was scattered all the way to the Jordan. I mean, it shows that God's miracle was progressive. It's like they heard this army coming after them, and they heard it following them. And so they carried some stuff with them, but, you know, as you're getting tired and the army's getting closer, you just chuck a few things and you're running faster. Now, notice what these lepers were doing. The lepers came and showed the way for eating clean food. The people on the city wall had been eating their own children. And also in this story, you can see how unbelief is dangerous. This unbelieving officer. You know, if you're an unbelieving person in relation to the things of God, it tempts you to make bad statements regarding God's promises or his power. Because this officer, when he heard about what the price of food was going to be, he said, if God would open the windows of heaven, would that be possible? You can see what an arrogant statement that was. I mean, there's going to be abundance, but even if it's abundance, could it be that cheap? His attitude was, is it even possible for God to do this? He's not saying, is it possible that God will do this? But he's even saying, is it even possible that he could do this? And Elisha immediately gives him a devastating rebuke. You will see it, but you will not benefit from it. Now, why is that a particularly apt judgment? You know, God is known by the judgments he metes out. You can see how that, okay, you said it's not possible. In your mind, it's not possible for God to do this. Then you need to see what God can do. That's the first part. But then he doesn't get the taste of it. And of course, it was fulfilled. He experienced death by the people trampling him as they rushed out of the city to get the spoil. You see, it could be he even thought the judgment wouldn't happen because I'm a royal officer. If there is food out there, I'll certainly get some of it. Notice the emphasis at the end of this chapter. The emphasis is the exact fulfillment of Elisha's prophecy. It has that repetition. To remind you, this is what was said, this is what Elisha said, and thus it was done exactly like Elisha said. There's a strong coupling between the Lord's word and Elisha's word. And I believe one of the great needs we have today is for people to be standing for what God says and to be presenting what God says and unflinchingly saying what God says instead of making up all kinds of messages of their own. Now, does anyone have any observations that you would like to make about this account of Elisha? That's an example of doing good to their enemy. Now, it's like they shouldn't have gone after Elisha, but he took them up there and made a special point of serving them a meal at that place. That reminds me of a story I read about a believer that was traveling out of an oppressed country in Africa. And he was a young man. He was trying to get to another place, and he went to room with some other Christians in Egypt, I think it was. And he was horrified to find out the low level of Christianity these men had. They would pay a harlot for her services. They scoffed at him for not doing such things. And so his desire was to minister to both those men and their women. So he talked to these men, and he said to them, "I'd like for you to be willing to try something." He told them what his proposal was, and they thought it was crazy. But they thought they'd try it. And his proposal was, when she comes tonight, and they would all use this same woman, when she comes, I want everybody to give her what her fee would be without using her. They thought it was crazy, but they were willing to try it. So she came in, and then this man, who was a true believer, began talking to her and explaining what they were going to do and how it was going to be, and he knew she needed money for her children and all these kind of things. And, of course, she had never heard of such a thing. And so she was greatly ministered to, and he sent her away then with this money, and then those other men were ministered to also, and there was repentance. And I thought it was a marvelous story, because our inclination would be to decide in one direction or the other. And he was saying, "I want to minister to both of them. These men are terribly needy, and this woman is terribly needy. And so how can it be ministry to both?" It's sort of an illustration that relates to this. You know, Elisha is ministering to multiple people in different ways through these events. One of the things we need to be doing is looking for opportunities to maximize the benefit of a given situation.